Chapter 16. The head made hot chocolate in the kitchen, and they drank it in the formal parlor by the light of two gas lanterns. Clay thought the old man would suggest they go out to Academy Avenue later on, trolling for more volunteers in Ardai's army, but he seemed satisfied with what he had. The gasoline pump at the motor pool, the head told them, drew from a 400-gallon overhead tank. All they'd have to do was pull a plug. And there were 30-gallon sprayers in the greenhouse, at least a dozen. They could load up a pickup truck with them, perhaps, and back it down one of the ramps. Wait, Clay said. Before we start talking strategy, if you have a theory about all this, sir, I'd like to hear it.
Nothing so formal, the old man said. But Jordan and I have observation, we have intuition, and we have a fair amount of experience between the two of us.
I'm a computer geek, Jordan said over his mug of hot chocolate. Clay found the child's glum assurance oddly charming. A total McNerd. Been on 'em my whole life, just about. Those things are rebooting, all right. They might as well have software installation please stand by blinking on their foreheads.
I don't understand you, Tom said.
I do, Alice said. Jordan, you think the pulse really was a pulse, don't you? Everyone who heard it, they got their hard drives wiped.
Well, yeah, Jordan said.
He was too polite to say, well, duh. Tom looked at Alice, perplexed. Only Clay knew Tom wasn't dumb, and he didn't believe Tom was that slow.
You had a computer, Alice said. I saw it in your little office.
Yes?
And you've installed software, right?
Sure, but... Tom stopped, looking at Alice fixedly. She looked back.
Their brains?
You mean their brains?
What do you think a brain is? Jordan said. A big old hard drive. Organic circuitry. No one knows how many bytes. Say, giga to the power of a Googleplex. An infinity of bytes.
He put his hands to his ears, which were small and neatly made.
Right in between here.
I don't believe it, Tom said, but he spoke in a small voice, and there was a sick look on his face. Clay thought he did believe it. Thinking back to the madness that had convulsed Boston, Clay had to admit the idea was persuasive. It was also terrible. Millions, perhaps even billions, of brains, all wiped clean at the same time, the way you could wipe an old-fashioned computer disk with a powerful magnet. He found himself remembering Pixie Dark, the friend of the girl with the peppermint-colored cell phone.
Who are you? What's happening?
Pixie Dark had cried.
Who are you? Who am I?
Then she had smacked herself repeatedly in the forehead with the heel of her hand and had gone running full tilt into a lamppost, not once but twice, smashing her expensive orthodontic work to jagged pieces. Who are you? Who am I? It hadn't been her cell phone. She had only been listening in and hadn't gotten a full dose. Clay, who thought in images rather than words a good deal of the time, now got a vivid mental picture of a computer screen filling up with those words. Who are you? Who am I? 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 And finally, at the bottom, as bleak and inarguable as Pixie Dark's fate, system failure. Pixie Dark is a partially wiped hard drive. It was horrible, but it felt like the stone truth.
I majored in English, but as a young man I read a great deal of psychology, the head told them. I began with Freud, of course. Everyone begins with Freud. Then Jung, Adler, worked my way around the whole ball field from there. Lurking behind all theories of how the mind works is a greater theory, Darwin's. In Freud's vocabulary, the idea of survival as the prime directive is expressed by the concept of the id. In Jung's, by the rather grander idea of blood consciousness. Neither man, I think, would argue with the idea that if all conscious thought, all memory, all ratiocinative ability were to be stripped from a human mind in a moment, what would remain would be pure and terrible.
He paused, looking around for comment. None of them said anything. The head nodded, as if satisfied, and resumed.
Although neither the Freudians nor the Jungians come right out and say it, they strongly suggest that we may have a core, a single basic carrier wave, or to use language with which Jordan is comfortable, a single line of written code which cannot be stripped.
The PD, Jordan said. The Prime Directive.
Yes, the head agreed. At bottom, you see, we are not Homo sapiens at all. Our core is madness. The Prime Directive is murder. What Darwin was too polite to say, my friends, is that we came to rule the Earth not because we were the smartest or even the meanest, but because we have always been the craziest, most murderous motherfuckers in the jungle. And that is what the Pulse exposed 5 days ago.
Chapter 17. I refuse to believe that we were lunatics and murderers before we were anything else, Tom said.
Christ, man, what about the Parthenon? What about Michelangelo's David? What about that plaque on the moon that says, "We came in peace for all mankind"?
That plaque also has Richard Nixon's name on it,
Ardai said dryly.
A Quaker, but hardly a man of peace. Mr. McCourt, Tom, I have no interest in handing down an indictment of mankind. If I did, I'd point out that for every Michelangelo there's a Marquis de Sade, for every Gandhi an Eichmann, for every Martin Luther King an Osama bin Laden. Leave it at this. Man has come to dominate the planet thanks to two essential traits. One is intelligence. The other has been the absolute willingness to kill anyone and anything that gets in his way.
He leaned forward, surveying them with his bright eyes.
Mankind's intelligence finally trumped mankind's killer instinct, and reason came to rule over mankind's maddest impulses. That, too, was survival. I believe the final showdown between the two may have come in October of 1963 over a handful of missiles in Cuba, but that is a discussion for another day. The fact is, most of us had sublimated the worst in us until the Pulse came along and stripped away everything but that red core.
Someone let the Tasmanian devil out of its cage, Alice murmured.
Who?
That need not concern us either, the head replied. I suspect they had no idea of what they were doing, or how much they were doing. Based upon what must have been hurried experiments over a few years, perhaps even months, they may have thought they would unleash a destructive storm of terrorism. Instead, they unleashed a tsunami of untold violence, and it's mutating. Horrible as the current days may now seem, we may later view them as a lull between one storm and the next. These days may also be our only chance to make a difference.
What do you mean, mutating? Clay asked. But the head didn't answer. Instead, he turned to 12-year-old Jordan.
If you please, young man.
Yes, well, Jordan paused to think. Your conscious mind only uses a tiny percentage of your brain's capacity. You guys know that, right?
Yes, Tom said, a bit indulgently. So I've read.
Jordan nodded. Even when you add in all the autonomic functions they control, plus the subconscious stuff, dreams, blink think, the sex drive, all that jazz, our brains are barely ticking over.
Holmes, you astound me, Tom said.
Don't be a wise ass, Tom, Alice said, and Jordan gave her a decidedly starry-eyed smile.
I'm not, Tom said. The kid is good.
Indeed he is, the headmaster said dryly. Jordan may have occasional problems with the King's English, but he did not get his scholarship for excelling at Tiddlywinks.
He observed the boy's discomfort and gave Jordan's hair an affectionate scruff with his bony fingers.
Continue, please.
Well,
Jordan struggled, Clay could see it, and then seemed to find his rhythm again.
If your brain really was a hard drive, the can would be almost empty.
He saw only Alice understood this.
Put it this way. The info strip would say something like 2% in use, 98% available. No one has any real idea what that 98% is for, but there's plenty of potential there. Stroke victims, for instance, they sometimes access previously dormant areas of their brains in order to walk and talk again. It's like their brains wire around the blighted area. The lights go on in a similar area of the brain, but on the other side.
You study this stuff? Clay asked.
It's a natural outgrowth of my interest in computers and cybernetics, Jordan said, shrugging. Also, I read a lot of cyberpunk science fiction. William Gibson, Bruce Sterling, John Shirley?
Neal Stephenson? Alice asked. Jordan grinned radiantly.
Neal Stephenson's a god!
Back on message, the head chided, but gently. Jordan shrugged.
If you wipe a computer hard drive, it can't regenerate spontaneously, except maybe in a Greg Bear novel.
He grinned again, but this time it was quick, and Clay thought rather nervous. Part of it was Alice, who clearly knocked the kid out.
People are different.
But there's a huge leap between learning to walk again after a stroke and being able to power a bunch of boomboxes by telepathy, Tom said. A quantum leap. He looked around self-consciously as the word telepathy came out of his mouth, as if expecting them to laugh. No one did.
Yeah, but a stroke victim, even someone who has a bad one, is light years different from what happened to people who were on their cells during the pulse, Jordan replied. Me and the head and I, think that in addition to stripping people's brains all the way to that one unerasable line of code, the pulse also kicked something on. Something that's probably been sitting inside all of us for millions of years, buried in that 98% of dormant hard drive.
Clay's hand stole to the butt of the revolver he had picked up off the floor in Beth Nickerson's kitchen. A trigger, he said. Jordan lit up.
Yeah, exactly. A mutative trigger. It never could have happened without this, like, total erasure on a grand scale, because what's emerging, what's building up in those people out there, only they're no longer people. What's building up is,
it's a single organism, the head interrupted. This is what we believe.
Yes, but more than just a flock, Jordan said. Because what they can do with the CD players may only be the start, like a little kid learning to put his shoes on. Think about what they might be able to do in a week, or a month, or a year.
You could be wrong, Tom said, but his voice was dry as a breaking stick.
He could also be right, Alice said.
Oh, I'm sure he's right, the head put in. He sipped his spiked hot chocolate. Of course, I'm an old man, and my time is almost over in any case. I'll abide by any decision you make. A slight pause. The eyes flicked from Clay to Alice to Tom. As long as it's the right one, of course.
Jordan said, The flocks will try to come together, you know. If they don't hear each other already, they will real soon.
Crap, Tom said uneasily. Ghost stories.
Maybe, Clay said. But here's something to think about. Right now the nights are ours. What if they decide they need less sleep, or that they're not afraid of the dark?
No one said anything for several moments. A wind was rising outside. Clay sipped his hot chocolate, which had never been much more than tepid and was now almost cold. When he looked up again, Alice had put hers aside and was holding her Nike talisman instead.
I want to wipe them out, she said. The ones on the soccer field. I want to wipe them out. I don't say kill them because I think Jordan's right, and I don't want to do it for the human race. I want to do it for my mother and my dad, because he's gone too. I know he is. I feel it. I want to do it for my friends Vicky and Tess. They were good friends, but they had cell phones. They never went anywhere without them. And I know what they're like now and where they're sleeping. Someplace just like that fucking soccer field.
She glanced at the head, flushing.
Excuse me, sir.
The head waved her apology away.
Can we do that? She asked him. Can we wipe them out?
Charles Ardai, who had been winding down his career as Gayton Academy's interim headmaster when the world ended, bared his eroded teeth in a grin Clay would have given much to have captured with pen or brush. There was not a single ounce of pity in it.
Miss Maxwell, we can try, he said.
Chapter 18. At 4 o'clock the next morning, Tom McCourt sat on a picnic table between the two Gayton Academy greenhouses, which had both sustained serious damage since the pulse. His feet, now wearing the Reeboks he'd donned back in Malden, were on one of the benches, and his head lay on his arms, which rested on his knees. The wind blew his hair first one way, then the other. Alice sat across from him with her chin propped on her hands and the rays of several flashlights striking angles and shadows across her face. The harsh light made her look pretty in spite of her obvious weariness. At her age, all light was still flattering. The head, sitting next to her, only looked exhausted. In the closer of the two greenhouses, two Coleman gas lanterns floated like uneasy spirits. The Colemans converged at the near end of the greenhouse. Clay and Jordan used the door, although huge holes in the glass paneling had been opened on either side. A moment later, Clay sat down next to Tom and Jordan resumed his usual spot next to the head. The boy smelled of gasoline and fertilizer, even more strongly of dejection. Clay dropped several sets of keys on the table amid the flashlights. As far as he was concerned, they could stay there until some archaeologist discovered them 4 millennia from now.
"I'm sorry," Headmaster Ardai said softly. "It seemed so simple."
"Yeah," Clay said. It had seemed simple. Fill the greenhouse sprayers with gasoline, load the sprayers into the back of a pickup truck, drive across Tunney Field, wetting down both sides as they went, toss a match. He thought to tell Ardai that George W. Bush's Iraq adventure had probably looked equally simple. Load the sprayers, toss a match, and didn't. It would have been pointlessly cruel. "Tom?" Clay asked. "You okay?" He had already realized that Tom didn't have great reserves of stamina.
"Yeah, just tired."
He raised his head and gave Clay a smile.
"Not used to the night shift. What do we do now?"
"Go to bed, I guess," Clay said. "It'll be dawn in another 40 minutes or so." The sky had already begun to lighten in the east.
"It's not fair," Alice said. She brushed angrily at her cheeks. "It's not fair. We tried so hard."
They had tried hard, but nothing had come easily. Every small and ultimately meaningless victory had been the sort of maddening struggle his mother had called a bullshit shit pull. Part of Clay did want to blame the head, also himself, for not taking Ardai's sprayer idea with a grain of salt. Part of him now thought that going along with an elderly English teacher's plan to firebomb a soccer field was a little like taking a knife to a gunfight. Still, yeah, it had seemed like a good idea. Until, that was, they discovered the motor pool's gasoline storage tank was inside a locked shed. They'd spent nearly half an hour in the nearby office, scrounging by lantern light through maddeningly unmarked keys on a board behind the superintendent's desk. It was Jordan who finally found the key that unlocked the shed door. Then they discovered that one would only have to pull a plug was not exactly the case. There was a cap, not a plug. And like the shed in which the tank resided, the cap was locked. Back to the office. Another scrounge by lantern light. Finally, a key that did indeed seem to fit the cap. It was Alice who pointed out that since the cap was on the bottom of the tank, assuring gravity feed in case of a power outage, they would have a flood on their hands without a hose or a siphon. They spent an hour looking for a hose that might fit and couldn't find anything that looked even close. Tom found a small funnel, which sent them all into moderate hysterics. And because none of the truck keys were marked, at least in ways non-motor pool employees could understand, locating the right set became another process of trial and error. This one went faster, at least, because there were only 8 trucks parked behind the garage. And last, the greenhouses. There they discovered only 8 sprayers, not a dozen, with a capacity of not 30 gallons each, but 10. They might be able to fill them from the gasoline storage tank, but they would be drenched in the process, and the result would be a mere 80 gallons of usable, sprayable gas. It was the idea of wiping out 1,000 phone crazies with 80 gallons of regular that had driven Tom, Alice, and the head out to the picnic bench. Clay and Jordan had hung in a while longer, looking for bigger sprayers, but they had found none. "We found a few little leaf sprayers, though," Clay said. "You know, what they used to call flit guns."
"Also," Jordan said, "the big sprayers in there are all full of weed killer or plant food or something. We'd have to start by dumping them all out, and that would mean putting on masks just to make sure we didn't gas ourselves or something."
"Reality bites," Alice said morosely. She looked at her baby sneaker for a moment, then tucked it away in her pocket. Jordan picked up the keys they had matched to one of the maintenance pickups.
We could drive downtown, he said. There's a trustworthy hardware. They must have sprayers.
Tom shook his head.
It's over a mile, and the main drag's full of wrecks and abandoned vehicles. We might be able to get around some, but not all. And driving over the lawns is out of the question. The houses are just too close together.
There are reasons everybody's on foot. They had seen a few people on bicycles, but not many. Even the ones equipped with lights were dangerous if ridden at any speed.
Would it be possible for a light truck to negotiate the side streets? The head asked.
Clay said, We could explore the possibility tomorrow night, I suppose. Scout out a path in advance on foot and come back for the truck. He considered. They'd probably have all sorts of hose in a hardware store, too.
You don't sound exactly jazzed, Alice said.
Clay sighed. It doesn't take much to block little streets. We'd end up doing a lot of donkey work, even if we got luckier than we did tonight.
I just don't know. Maybe it'll look better to me after some rest.
Of course it will, the head agreed, but he sounded hollow. To all of us.
What about the gas station across from the school? Jordan asked without much hope.
What gas station? Alice asked.
He's talking about the Citgo, the head replied. Same problem, Jordan. Plenty of gasoline in the tanks under the pumps, but no power. And I doubt if they have much in the way of containers beyond a few 2 or 5 gallon gasoline cans. I really think...
But he didn't say what he really thought. He broke off.
What is it, Clay?
Clay was remembering the trio ahead of them limping past that gas station, one of the men with an arm around the woman's waist.
Academy Grove Citgo, he said. That's the name, isn't it?
Yes.
But they didn't just sell gasoline, I think.
He didn't just think, he knew. Because of the 2 trucks parked on the side. He had seen them and hadn't thought anything of them. Not then he hadn't, no reason to.
I don't know what you...
The head began, then stopped. His eyes met Clay's. His eroded teeth once more made their appearance in that singularly pitiless smile.
Oh, he said. Oh my. Oh my, yes.
Tom was looking between them with mounting perplexity. So was Alice. Jordan merely waited.
Would you mind telling the rest of us what you two are communing about? Tom asked.
Clay was ready to. He already saw clearly how it would work, and it was too good not to share, when the music from Tunney Field died away. It didn't click off, as it usually did when they woke up in the morning. It went in a kind of swoop, as if someone had just kicked the source down an elevator shaft.
They're up early, Jordan said in a low voice.
Tom gripped Clay's forearm.
It's not the same, he said, and one of those damned ghetto blasters is still playing. I can hear it, very faint.
The wind was strong, and Clay knew it was blowing from the direction of the soccer field because of the ripe smell it carried. Decaying food, decaying flesh, hundreds of unwashed bodies. It also carried the ghostly sound of Lawrence Welk and his champagne music makers playing Baby Elephant Walk. Then, from somewhere to the northwest, maybe 10 miles away, maybe 30, it was hard to tell how far the wind might have carried it, came a spectral, somehow moth-like moaning sound. There was silence. Silence. And then the not-waking, not-sleeping creatures on the Tunney soccer field answered in kind. Their moan was much louder, a hollow, belling ghost groan that rose toward the black and starry sky. Alice had covered her mouth. The baby sneaker jutted upward from her hands. Her eyes bulged on either side of it. Jordan had thrown his arms against the head's waist and buried his face against the old man's side.
Look, Clay, Tom said.
He got to his feet and tottered toward the grassy aisle between the 2 shattered greenhouses, pointing at the sky as he went.
Do you see? My God, do you see?
To the northwest, from where the distant groan had risen, a reddish-orange glow had bloomed on the horizon. It strengthened as he watched. The wind bore that terrible sound again, and once more it was answered with a similar but much louder groan from Tunney Field. Alice joined them, then the head walking with his arm around Jordan's shoulders.
"What's over there?" Clay asked, pointing toward the glow. It had already begun to wane again.
"It might be Glen's Falls," the headmaster said. "Or it might be Littleton."
"Wherever it is, there's shrimp on the barbie," Tom said.
"They're burning.
And our bunch knows. They heard."
"Or felt," Alice said.
She shuddered, then straightened and bared her teeth.
"I hope they did."
As if in answer, there was another groan from Tunney Field, many voices raised as one in a cry of sympathy and perhaps shared agony. The one boombox, it was the master, Clay assumed, the one with an actual compact disc in it, continued to play. 10 minutes later, the others joined in once more. The music, it now was Close to You by the Carpenters, swooped up, just as it had previously swooped down. By then, Headmaster Ardai, limping noticeably on his cane, had led them back to Cheatham Lodge. Not long after that, the music stopped again, but this time it simply clicked off, as it had the previous morning. From far away, carried across God alone knew how many miles by the wind, came the faint pop of a gunshot. Then the world was eerily and completely silent, waiting for the dark to give place to the day. Chapter 19. As the sun began to spoke its first red rays through the trees on the eastern horizon, they watched the phone crazies once again begin leaving the soccer field in close order patterns, headed for downtown Gayton and the surrounding neighborhoods. They fanned out as they went, headed downhill toward Academy Avenue, as if nothing untoward had happened near the end of the night. But Clay didn't trust that. He thought they had better do their business at the Sitco station quickly, today, if they intended to do it at all. Going out in the daylight might mean shooting some of them, but as long as they only moved en masse at the beginning and end of the day, he was willing to take that risk. They watched what Alice called the dawn of the dead from the dining room. Afterward, Tom and the head went into the kitchen. Clay found them sitting at the table in a bar of sunshine and drinking tepid coffee. Before Clay could begin explaining what he wanted to do later in the day, Jordan touched his wrist.
"Some of the crazies are still there," he said, and in a lower voice. "I went to school with some of them."
Tom said, "I thought they'd all be shopping Kmart by now, looking for blue light specials."
"You better check it out," Alice said from the doorway. "I'm not sure it's another, what would you call it, developmental step forward, but it might be. It probably is."
"Sure it is," Jordan said gloomily. The phone crazies who had stayed behind, Clay thought it was a squad of about 100, were removing the dead from beneath the bleachers. At first, they simply carried them off into the parking lot south of the field and behind a long, low brick building. They came back empty-handed.
"That building's the indoor track," the head told them. "It's also where all the sports gear is stored. There's a steep drop-off on the far side. I imagine they're throwing the bodies over the edge."
"You bet," Jordan said. He sounded sick. "It's all marshy down there. They'll rot."
"They were rotting anyway, Jordan," Tom said gently.
"I know,"
he said, sounding sicker than ever.
"But they'll rot even faster in the sun."
A pause.
"Sir?"
"Yes, Jordan?"
"I saw Noah Chutsky from your drama reading club."
The head patted the boy's shoulder. He was very pale.
"Never mind."
"It's hard not to," Jordan whispered.
"He took my picture once. With his, you know."
Then, a new wrinkle. 2 dozen of the worker bees peeled off from the main group with no pause for discussion, and headed for the shattered greenhouses, moving in a V-shape that reminded the watchers of migrating geese. The one Jordan had identified as Noah Chutsky was among these. The rest of the body removal squad watched them go for a moment, then marched back down the ramps, 3 abreast, and resumed fishing dead bodies out from under the bleachers. 20 minutes later, the greenhouse party returned, now spread out in a single line. Some were still empty-handed, but most had acquired wheelbarrows or hand carts of the sort used to transport large bags of lime or fertilizer. Soon the phone crazies were using the carts and barrows to dispose of the bodies,
and their work went faster. "It's a step forward, all right," Tom said.
"More than one," the head added. "Cleaning house, using tools to do it."
Clay said, "I don't like this." Jordan looked up at him, his face pale and tired and far older than its years.
"Join the club," he said.
Chapter 20. They slept until 1 in the afternoon. Then, after confirming that the body detail had finished its work and gone to join the rest of the foragers, they went down to the field stone pillars marking the entrance to Gaten Academy. Alice had scoffed at Clay's idea that he and Tom should do this on their own.
"Never mind that Batman and Robin crap," she said.
"Oh my, I always wanted to be the boy wonder,"
Tom said with a trace of a lisp. But when she gave him a humorless look, her sneaker now beginning to look a bit tattered, clasped in one hand, he wilted.
"Sorry."
"You can go across to the gas station on your own," she said. "That much makes sense. But the rest of us will stand lookout on the other side."
The head had suggested that Jordan should stay behind at the lodge. Before the boy could respond, and he looked ready to do so hotly, Alice asked,
"How are your eyes, Jordan?"
He had given her a smile, once more accompanied by the slightly starry look.
"Good, fine. And you've played video games? The ones where you shoot?"
"Sure, a ton."
She handed him her pistol. Clay could see him quiver slightly, like a tapped tuning fork, when their fingers touched.
"If I tell you to point and shoot, or if Headmaster Ardai tells you, will you do it?"
"Sure."
Alice had looked at Ardai with a mixture of defiance and apology.
"We need every hand."
The head had given in, and now here they were, and there was the Academy Grove Sitco on the other side of the street and just a little way back toward town. From here, the other slightly smaller sign was easy to read. Academy LP Gas. The single car standing at the pumps with its driver's door open already had a dusty, long, deserted look. The gas station's big plate glass window was broken. Off to the right, parked in the shade of what had to be one of northern New England's few surviving elm trees, were two trucks shaped like giant propane bottles. Written on the side of each were the words, "Academy LP Gas," and "Serving Southern New Hampshire since 1982. There was no sign of foraging phone crazies on this part of Academy Avenue, and although most of the houses Clay could see had shoes on their front stoops, several did not. The rush of refugees seemed to be drying up.
"Too early to tell," he cautioned himself.
"Sir? Clay? What's that?" Jordan asked.
He was pointing to the middle of the avenue, which of course was still Route 102, although that was easy to forget on this sunny, quiet afternoon, where the closest sounds were birds and the rustle of the wind in the leaves. There was something written in bright pink chalk on the asphalt, but from where they were, Clay couldn't make it out. He shook his head.
"Are you ready?" he asked Tom.
"Sure," Tom said. He was trying to sound casual, but a pulse beat rapidly on the side of his unshaven throat.
"You Batman, me Boy Wonder."
They trotted across the street, pistols in hand. Clay had left the Russian automatic weapon with Alice, more or less convinced it would spin her around like a top if she actually had to use it. The message scrawled in pink chalk on the macadam was, "Cashwalk equals no foe."
"Does that mean anything to you?" Tom asked.
Clay shook his head. It didn't, and right now he didn't care. All he wanted was to get out of the middle of Academy Avenue, where he felt as exposed as an ant in a bowl of rice. It occurred to him, suddenly and not for the first time, that he would sell his soul just to know that his son was okay, and in a place where people weren't putting guns into the hands of children who were good at video games. It was strange. He'd think he had his priorities settled, that he was dealing with his personal deck one card at a time, and then these thoughts would come, each as fresh and painful as an unsettled grief.
"Get out of here, Johnny. You don't belong here. Not your place. Not your time."
The propane trucks were empty and locked, but that was all right. Today their luck was running the right way. The keys were hanging on a board in the office below a sign reading, "No towing between midnight and 6 a.m., no exemptions."
A tiny propane bottle dangled from each keychain. Halfway back to the door, Tom touched Clay's shoulder. Two phone crazies walked up the middle of the street, side by side but by no means in lockstep. One was eating Twinkies from a box of them. His face was lathered with cream, crumbs, and frosting. The other, a woman, was holding a coffee table-sized book out in front of her. To Clay, she looked like a choir member holding an oversized hymnal. On the front, there appeared to be a photograph of a collie jumping through a tire swing. The fact that the woman held the book upside down gave Clay some comfort. The vacant, blasted expressions on their faces, and the fact that they were wandering on their own, meaning midday was still a non-flocking time, gave him more. But he didn't like that book. No, he didn't like that book at all. They wandered past the fieldstone pillars, and Clay could see Alice, Jordan, and the head peering out, wide-eyed. The two crazies walked over the cryptic message chalked in the street, Koshwak equals no foe, and the woman reached for her companion's Twinkies. The man held the box away from her. The woman cast her book aside, it landed right side up, and Clay saw it was 100 best-loved dogs of the world, and reached again. The man slapped her face hard enough to make her filthy hair fly, the sound very loud in the stillness of the day. All this time they were walking. The woman made a sound. Aw. The man replied. It sounded to Clay like a reply. Een. The woman reached for the box of Twinkies. Now they were passing the sit-go. The man punched her in the neck this time, a looping overhand blow, and then dove a hand into his box for another treat. The woman stopped, looked at him, and a moment later the man stopped. He had pulled a bit ahead, so his back was mostly to her. Clay felt something in the sun-warmed stillness of the gas station office. No, he thought, not in the office, in me. Shortness of breath, like after you climb a flight of stairs too fast. Except maybe it was in the office too, because Tom stood on his toes and whispered in his ear, "Do you feel that?" Clay nodded and pointed at the desk. There was no wind, no discernible draft, but the papers there were fluttering. And in the ashtray, the ashes had begun to circle, lazily, like water going down a bathtub drain. There were two butts in there, no, three, and the moving ashes seemed to be pushing them toward the center. The man turned toward the woman. He looked back at her. She looked at him. They looked at each other. Clay could read no expression on either face, but he could feel the hairs on his arms stirring, and he heard a faint jingling. It was the keys on the board below the no-towing sign. They were stirring, too, chittering against each other just the tiniest bit. "Aw," said the woman. She held out her hand. "Een," said the man. He was wearing the fading remains of a suit. On his feet were dull black shoes. 6 days ago, he might have been a middle manager, a salesman or an apartment complex manager. Now the only real estate he cared about was his box of Twinkies. He held it to his chest, his sticky mouth working. "Aw," the woman insisted. She held out both hands instead of just one, the immemorial gesture signifying gimme, and the keys were jingling louder. Overhead, there was a bzzz, as a fluorescent light for which there was no power flickered and then went out again. The nozzle fell off the middle gas pump and hit the concrete island with a dead metal clank. "Aw," the man said. His shoulders slumped, and all the tension went out of him. The tension went out of the air. The keys on the board fell silent. The ashes made one final slowing circuit of their dented metal reliquary and came to a stop. You would not have known anything had happened, Clay thought, if not for the fallen nozzle out there and the little cluster of cigarette butts in the ashtray on the desk in here. "Aw," the woman said. She was still holding out her hands. Her companion advanced to within reach of them. She took a Twinkie in each and began to eat them, wrappings and all. Once more, Clay was comforted, but only a little. They resumed their slow shuffle toward town, the woman pausing long enough to spit a filling-caked piece of cellophane from the side of her mouth. She showed no interest in 100 best-loved dogs of the world. "What was that?" Tom asked in a low and shaken voice when the two of them were almost out of sight.
I don't know, but I didn't like it, Clay said. He had the keys to the propane trucks. He handed one set to Tom. Can you drive a standard shift? I learned on a standard. Can you? Clay smiled patiently. I'm straight, Tom. Straight guys know how to drive standards without instruction. It's instinct with us. Very funny. Tom wasn't really listening. He was looking after the departed odd couple, and that pulse in the side of his throat was going faster than ever. End of the world. Open season on the queers. Why not, right? That's right. It's going to be open season on straights, too, if they get that shit under control. Come on, let's do it. He started out the door, but Tom held him back a minute. Listen, the others may have felt that over there, or they may not have. If they didn't, maybe we should keep it to ourselves for the time being. What do you think? Clay thought about how Jordan wouldn't let the head out of his sight, and how Alice always kept the creepy little sneaker somewhere within reach. He thought about the circles under their eyes, and then about what they were planning to do tonight. Armageddon was probably too strong a word for it, but not by much. Whatever they were now, the phone crazies had once been human beings, and burning 1,000 of them alive was burden enough. Even thinking about it hurt his imagination. Fine by me, he said. Go up the hill in low gear, all right? Lowest one I can find, Tom said. They were walking to the big bottle-shaped trucks now. How many gears do you think a truck like that has? One forward should be enough, Clay said. Based on the way they're parked, I think you're going to have to start by finding reverse. Fuck it, Clay said. What good is the end of the world if you can't drive through a goddamn board fence? And that was what they did.